Soon we'll be done with the trouble of this world, with the trouble of this world, with the trouble of this world. Soon we'll be done with the trouble of this world. I'm going home to live with God, my Lord.
Welcome to Sup Media Reviews, the podcast that never needs spoiler alerts because it takes you back in time to relive the nostalgia of classic TV shows and films that you've probably already seen. I'm your host, Kiara, and each week I'll dive into the archives to bring you my take on movies and TV shows from at least 20 years ago. From cult classics to forgotten gems, I'll review them all and give my honest opinion on their impact and whether or not they still hold up today. Join me as we revisit the iconic characters, memorable moments, and timeless themes that made these shows and films so special. So take a break from adulting and get ready for a trip down memory lane with Sup Media Reviews. What's up, Home Slices? Thanks so much for tuning into Sup Media Reviews. I'm your host, Kiara, and I'm excited to review a movie that I've been wanting to watch for 20 years. The 2004 remake of The Lady Killers, featuring Tom Hanks as Professor G.H. Dorr, Marlon Wayans as Gawain McSam, Irma P. Hall as Marva Munson, and J.K. Simmons as Garth Pancake. This movie was directed by the Coen brothers and had its 20th anniversary in March of this year. Now, back in the day, I always wanted to watch this movie because I was intrigued by the casting choices of Tom Hanks and Marlon Wayans particularly, but I never did watch the movie. Now that I have a podcast that allows me to watch old films, I get to check it out for myself. So it's going to be fun, y'all. So as always, here are some fun facts about the movie. The original is a British film where five oddball criminals who are planning to rob a bank rent rooms on a cul-de-sac from an octogenarian widow under the pretext that they are classical musicians. In the 2004 remake, five criminals led by a charming southern professor rent rooms from an older lady while they plan to rob a casino under the guise that they are a classical ensemble. Now, prior to filming, Tom Hanks had not seen The Lady Killers from 1955 as he didn't want to prejudice the way he acted in the remake. Similarly, I'm curious to see what critics had to say about this film, and I purposely avoided looking at the ratings so I didn't ruin it myself. I also have not seen the original Lady Killers either. I'm not keen on watching super old movies, ones that like might be in black and white, so I really had no context for what would happen in the story at all, so I went into it literally like fresh-eyed. Now, the next fun fact is that Blake Clark, who plays the coach in the football scene, also played Farmer Fran in Waterboy, which came out in 98. Ryan Hurst, who plays Lump in this film, from whose point of view that football scene was shot, is known for his role in Remember the Titans, which came out in 2000. Now, even the We Are Farmers, bum 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 guy, J.K. Simmons, is in this movie, and so with Tom Hanks, Marlon Wayans, and some of these other characters, we actually have some stars in this movie. So the casting is quite interesting, and we'll see how the movie goes, y'all. But in this final fun fact, Marva Munson, who's played by Irma P. Hall, is the owner of the house that the robbers use, and she bears the same name as the judge in another Coen Brothers film called Intolerable Cruelty, which came out in 2003. In both cases, the women are African American. Now, you may know Irma P. Hall as Big Mama from Soul Food. Now, I reviewed Soul Food last year. It is episode 32, so check it out if you haven't already. If you want to watch The Lady Killers from 2004, unfortunately, you'll have to rent it as of the recording of this episode. As always, I like to rent films from Amazon Prime because of their X-ray IMDb feature. To my shock, however, this particular movie does not even have the X-ray feature on Amazon Prime. So if you want to rent this movie, I suggest you rent it from wherever you can get it for the cheapest. Now let's talk about my personal connection. I have never seen this movie, so I don't really have a personal connection to this film, other than the fact that I was 13 when it came out, and I remember watching the advertisements for the film and being really interested in seeing a movie that had Tom Hanks, Marlon Wayans, and Big Mama from Soul Food in it, okay? I was able to pick up on the fact that Irma P. Hall's character was kind of outsmarting the man, which seemed pretty cool too. So the term lady killer is defined as a man who's irresistible to women or has the reputation for being so. So I'm interested to see how that definition plays into this story. The movie has a number of stars in it, so it'll probably be well acted, and I'm just really curious about this story and feel excited to watch it for the first time and share my point of view. So let's get into it. All right, the movie opens with a view of the sky, and the music is a kind of old school spiritual song by Sam Cooke and the Soul Stirrers called Come, Let's Go Back to God. The camera pans to what appears to be a large pillar with angry men-like gargoyles on it. A large black bird, like a raven, lands on it, and I'm trying to figure out what the symbolism is at this point. Typically, the scary figures on pillars and things like that are meant to keep birds away, but the bird doesn't seem to mind, so I'm wondering if this is supposed to be symbolism or if I'm just putting 20 on 10. This symbolism does come back later on. So you all, when I record my reviews, my notes are in order of what's happening in the movie. So if I've never seen a movie before, I'm literally reviewing it like scene by scene. And so things that I know and learn later on in the film are not in my notes. And so I try to reveal things as they happen in the movie. So bear that in mind as we go throughout this film, right? So this pillar is on a bridge, and we see a pretty bad CGI tugboat pulling what looks like CGI garbage. And speaking of CGI garbage, I don't like the way that this scene looks. It looks cartoony to me, but I'm guessing that the CGI wasn't bad for 20 years ago, I guess. But this little tugboat takes like a large barge full of trash to an island dumped that appears to be a large landfill. Why anyone would put a landfill in the middle of a water source is beyond me. But when we find out later where this story takes place, maybe that will answer some questions. Okay. So next up, we see a small building. It is the Saucier City Hall / Sheriff's Office. It's literally a square building, but the way that the scene is shot, it looks weird. It's almost like this building is superimposed over a white background. It's a little strange. But we see an old school car drive past this building, and it suggests that this movie takes place a little while ago in the past, at least. So inside the City Hall, we see a poster calling for the re-election of Sheriff Wayne Weiner, who is too old to go back to work. So it's telling us that this is a sleepy town, so sleepy that the sheriff and the deputy are literally sleeping in the sheriff's office, y'all. Literally, that poster that's telling them to re-elect the sheriff has a picture of Wayne, the current sheriff, who is played by George Wallace, with like some fish that he caught. So we can tell this is a really sleepy town. Not a lot goes on here, right? One of the jail cells is open. It's a sleepy town, y'all. It's just a small sleepy town. Now, enter Marva Munson, who is played by Irma P. Hall in this film, aka Big Mama. She comes into the sheriff's office, waking Wayne and his deputy, complaining that a young man named Wee Mac Funtis. I've never heard the name Funtis. A lot of people in this movie have strange names that I've never heard of before. Wee Mac, first off, a weird name. Funtis is an interesting last name. Never heard that last name before. But apparently, Wee Mac went down to Costco and bought himself what she calls a blaster. Initially, I thought it was a gun, but it's actually a boombox that Wee Mac uses to blast his hippity hop music. Now, she keeps repeating the lyric, "I left my wallet in El Segundo," because Wee Mac is playing that song loudly and it's disturbing her, right? So I had to look it up. I actually did not know that song. It's a song by Tribe Called Quest, and it actually came out in 1990. So I was a little surprised at how modern the timeline for this movie was. Based on some of the things that I saw in the film, I suspected that it was much older, like much, much older, like 50 years. 50 years older. But from context clues, we find out that Saucier, the town that they are in, is in the state of Mississippi. During Marva's rant, you know, she's just going on and on about things that are bothering her, particularly the boombox. She says something so funny that I literally laughed out loud and called my husband into the room to rewatch this scene. It was actually very funny. She's telling the sheriff about how the hippity hop music is disturbing her and Othar. We learn who Othar is later. And she tells the sheriff that the song, that those hip hop songs call colored folks the N-word with a hard R. Now, she says the actual word, and the way she says it is hilarious, y'all. I laughed out loud. I won't repeat the word here because I know that word is sensitive for some people, but you should definitely look up this particular scene. It was so funny. But it also depicts like a little bit of a generational divide in the use of the N-word, which of course has been discussed by far smarter people than myself. So we're not going to get into it. So Mrs. Munson finally reaches the conclusion of her rant. The officers don't seem to be paying her much attention. It comes across as if Miss Munson person interacts with them frequently and is one of those people that maybe call the police for things that aren't necessarily police matters, and they kind of don't take her seriously because of it. Almost a boy who cried wolf situation, but not exactly the same. I'm sure you all understand what I'm saying. There's some older people that you just let them talk and like kind of tucker themselves out. And that's the way Miss Marva comes across. But once she reaches the conclusion of her rant, she basically says that she wants the sheriff to show an interest in Wemack to alter his behavior and the kind of things that he allows to influence him. So she wants the sheriff to go down, talk to Wemack, maybe tell him to stop listening to all the hip hop music, right, or whatever. But then Marva says something that I have no idea what it means. She says, "You don't want to be tried and found wanting. Many, many done tunka low parson." Many, many done tunka low parson. And the sheriff is like, "What?" She says that it means that they've been tried and found wanting. Now, if you close your eyes and listen carefully, it sounds like she says, "Many, many have drunk a little poison." I still don't know what it means. And it never comes back up again. I literally don't know what this lady is talking about. And I don't know if it's supposed to be some type of dialect that I just don't understand or if I appropriately interpreted it or not. It literally doesn't come back again. And I don't know why it's in here. I really don't know. I think it's just supposed to show how she literally comes across as talking nonsense sometimes. And so they really take anything that she says with a grain of salt, which is a kind of recurring theme throughout the film. So we'll get more into that later. Yo, I think I even looked it up. I think I even Googled it. Let's see. Oh, okay. This is interesting. So I don't even know where this is, y'all. I'm on a website. I don't know what this is. I ain't finna tell y'all what it is. I might get a virus or something after this. But on this little board, it's like what do they used to call them? The little boards that you used to be able to go on to like write messages and reply to people. Message board. There we go. It's a message board that someone asked 13 years ago. 13 years ago, they asked what Marva meant by, you know, many, many done tunka low parson. Now, someone responded to them just a few months later saying that it's a garbled version of Mene Mene Tekel Aparzin, which is the mysterious writing on the wall from chapter 5 of the book of Daniel. She did mention something about the writing on the wall while she was there. Okay, y'all, I thought I was crazy. But yeah, she knows her Bible, apparently. And so Marva leaves the sheriff's office with a quote. The Apostle John said, "Behold, there's a stranger in our midst come to destroy us." So there's a little bit of foreshadowing there. But this scene is hilarious and tells us a lot about Marva and the town, right? Marva is very religious. She's older. She's retired. She's very traditional and conservative. She doesn't understand the new age wave of hip hop. She complains to the police about things that probably should just be handled between neighbors. And most of all, we see how she's received by the sheriff and his deputy. Like during the rant, the sheriff and deputy do like a bunch of yes ma'ams and mm-hmms and all right nows, and it's showing that because of who she is, people don't really take her seriously, and they see her rants as musings of an older retired lady with nothing to fill her time. So the cops, though, are ridiculously laid back and ineffectual, and it's probably stemming from the fact that they're in a smaller town where nothing big happens, so things aren't really required of them, which makes this town ripe for some of the events that happen later on, right? So Marva walks home through the town, and she is so bow-legged. I don't know that I ever noticed that about this actress before, but she is bow-legged, y'all. The city is a little bit run down, like in the town center, but her neighborhood is actually very pretty, and her house is actually very big and stately. It's pretty nice. It turns out that Othar, who she mentioned during her rant earlier, is her late husband, whose picture she talks to on her living room wall and tells about her day. She is 67. She was married for 46 years, and she has trouble sitting down, but turns out she has piles, which I had to look up, but it's an old term for hemorrhoids, which is interesting. There's a number of butt jokes in this in this movie, okay? But she talks briefly about how she wants to die in her sleep. And then suddenly, like, some ominous things happen, right? Like, a candle flickers, the cat in the house, whose name is Pickles, gets wound up, and then there's a knock at the door. Now, the cat, who is spooked, right, leaves the house when Marva opens the door, and the cat scurries up the tree in her front yard. The person who knocked on her door is Tom Hanks, who looks and sounds like Colonel Sanders. Now, Marva, without hesitation, asks the stranger to get the cat out of the tree. And the stranger says that the cat will come down eventually, but Marva is like, well, if you won't get the cat out of the tree because this is your fault, she'll have to call the cops, who have tired of having to retrieve the cat out of the tree for her. Now, when she mentions the cops, this stranger gets a little spooked and is basically forced to grab the cat himself. The character, Professor G.H., climbs the tree to get the cat, and then the branch falls to the ground along with the professor. One thing that was very interesting about this scene was the sense of entitlement that Marva had about how he knocked on the door. She opens the door for him, and it's his fault that the cat got out. I don't know how true that is. And her sense of entitlement of like, well, you better go get the cat out of the tree since you did this. It's like, I'm not saying that it's not something that would never happen. What I'm saying is, back when I reviewed Soul Food, Irma P. Hall's character was named Big Mama, right? And I asked a question in my review of Soul Food was Big Mama a good person? And I'm going to ask the same question here as we go throughout this, as we go throughout this story. Is Marva Munson a good person? So let's think about that as we talk more about this movie. So the scene cuts to the professor in the living room with like a little towel over his face, like I guess to help with an injury he got from falling out of the tree. He apologizes for letting the cat out in the first place. Again, I don't necessarily think it's his fault, but he introduces himself as Professor Goldthwaite. Y'all, Goldthwaite. I can't even say the name. It's G-O-L-D-T-H-W-A-I-T. Higginson Dorr, PhD. So it's G-H for short. So I will call him the professor or G-H. Now they do a weird conversation that is hilarious and meant to indicate that Marva is not well versed in the arts. She's not well traveled and she may not be very smart or have like high levels of education. So as G-H starts to rattle off his credentials, he has a PhD in ancient languages. She is unimpressed and likely doesn't even understand what he's saying. She's more proud of the Bob Jones University, which is a Christian college that she sends $5 a month to. This actually is a real Christian university in real life that has very strict rules. You can read about it online. No. G.H. has come there looking for a room to let, and Marva is charging $15 a week for a quiet tenant. Now, as they go to check out the house, G.H. reveals that he's on sabbatical from his professorship at the University of Mississippi at Hattiesburg and is taking a year off for a musical passion project. He has an ensemble that plays Renaissance music, not Beyonce Renaissance, but like the literal music from the Renaissance era for fairs and festivals in the area. So when he sees the religious paintings on the walls, he kind of changes his tune a little bit to say that they play music that is inspired by God, aka something like gospel music. Now, Marva is okay with this, is actually very okay with it because, of course, such a religious woman is proud to be around someone who is a gospel musician. She doesn't appear to be suspicious when he asks if she has a root cellar, which is a basement. Now they go down to check it out and G.H. is being super weird about how great the cellar acoustics will be. And he's making weird noises and even tests the texture of the soil because there's one wall of the cellar that literally appears to be earth. Like it's not. Typically, if you look at like an unfinished basement, the walls are usually cinder blocks. For whatever reason, there's a wall in the basement that is literally just the dirt. No cinder blocks, nothing. Like, it's literally just dirt, which I have never seen before. I don't know where houses are that exist like that. It's a little bit crazy. Like, things that live in the dirt could just get in your house. I don't know. Somebody could probably literally dig their way into your house. That's a little bit crazy, y'all. Anyways, so it looks like Marva has a new tenant who will lease a room as well as the rehearsal space in the basement. So he has a room upstairs. It's a simple room with like the bed looks a little bit bigger than a twin size. And then it's a fairly large basement or root cellar, as he calls it. Now we cut to the next scene where Gawain makes Sam. Y'all, Gawain is the craziest name I've ever heard. I actually have a hard time pronouncing it because it's so unfamiliar to me. And I can't tell if it's supposed to be like Dwayne or if I'm mispronouncing it, Gawain. Anyways, Gawain McSam, who is played by Marlon Wayans, and Weemack, the guy who Marvin mentioned earlier that had the boombox, is played by Jason Weaver. Now, these two are co-workers as janitors in the local casino. And so Jason Weaver, in this scene, I believe this is the only scene that he is in, is showing Gawain the ropes, right? It's Gawain's first day on the job. And he's like, okay, you got to do this, you got to do that. He's training him, right? Jason Weaver, if y'all do not know, is actually the singing voice of Simba from The Lion King. He also played Little Michael Jackson in the Jackson Story, the movie about their lives. He was in Smart Guy. He sang the chorus of that Chingy song. If you was my lady. Very accomplished guy. And yeah, he's in this film for a hot second. So anyways, while they're doing this training, Weemack refers to how he routinely finds mercy pads and tucks in the trash cans that they empty. I had to look it up. I'm like, what are they talking about? What is a mercy pad or a tuck? Now, apparently tucks is a company that makes pads that people use to relieve hemorrhoid discomfort. And I'm like, back to the hemorrhoids. Lots of butt stuff happens. Lots of butt jokes happens in this movie, y'all. And I was like, how am I supposed to know that? Anyways, neither he nor I know why these used products would be discarded on the gambling room floor, y'all. But as Weemack takes Gawain around the gambling boat, which is called the Bandit Queen, we learn more about their workplace. They have a boss named Mr. Gudge. The boat and three others are owned by the Mannix Corporation. And we even find the room where the money is counted and guarded by like this large, kind of nasty security guard named Elrond. Now, the area appears to be made of metal and is pretty secure. We briefly see Mr. Gudge, and Gawain greets him with a "What's up, my N-word," which is not a good first impression. And you all, right away, the depiction of Gawain is pretty awful. First off, I feel like at this point in his career, it was actually a little rare to see Marlon Wayans doing something without his brothers. There was one movie that he was in where it was him and Dwayne Martin and he was a ghost, or was it the other way around? Or Dwayne Martin was the ghost, something along those lines. But generally, he's mostly seen with his brothers. And I hate that in this movie where he is separate from his brothers, that he is being portrayed as like a dumb thug that doesn't know how to act at work. I don't like the character of Gawain and what he appears to be saying about Black youth. I'll just keep it at that, okay? Now, next up, we cut briefly to a dog food video shoot where J.K. Simmons is playing an animal wrangler called Garth Pancake. So this scene is a little ridiculous, but to save time, I'll say that Garth is a little stupid and ends up killing his animal on accident. Things are not going well for him on that job. It's a very silly scene and it's kind of funny. You might want to check it out just like that particular clip. It's kind of interesting. This next scene, though, is really interesting. I've never seen a POV shot quite like this. But in this scene, we are looking through the POV of a football player who is doing poorly. So we see what he sees like through his face mask or through his helmet. And so this football player isn't doing well during this game. He's getting tackled easily. He doesn't seem super intelligent, and he ends up fumbling a catch that results in the opposing team scoring a goal. So the coach, who is Blake Clark from Waterboy, berates him and even smacks him a little bit. So this player is called Lump Hudson, and he is played by Ryan Hurst from Remember the Titans. Now, in the next scene, two young Black men enter an Asian-owned donut shop trying to rob it. One of the young men is played by Aldis Hodge, who has come a long way, y'all, in 20 years, a very long way, okay? The male store owner, who we later learn is named the General and who's played by Tai Ma, comes from the back of the store, and the two robbers are easily taken down by this older Asian couple. Now, you may recognize Tai Ma from the Rush Hour movies. He played the dad whose daughter, Soo Young, was kidnapped. Now, this is another depiction of two young Black males who are robbing a local business. So, you all, their depiction of a number of Black youth in this film is not very good. And I'm kind of not here for it, but let's move on. Now, this next scene takes place at church, y'all. It's Sunday morning, and Marva is at the church service, and the choir is singing. They kind of getting down a little bit. The scene overall feels a little bit watered down from my experience in the Black church. Part of that is probably due to the fact that this film is directed by two white men. You have to watch the scene to know what I'm talking about, but something about it doesn't feel hyped enough. Like, it's missing the spirit a little bit. You'll have to watch it to know what I'm talking about. But anyway, the crowd is excited, but they're not excited enough, right? The choir is getting down, but they're not getting down enough. The choir director doesn't have enough energy while he's directing the choir, but his wardrobe and his hair is on point, right? The pulpit does not have a podium, which is weird. The preacher comes up after the song and does like a quick sermon on how the parishioners in the church need to smite the sinners, which he says is basically going upside the head of sinners who need it. He also brings up Garbage Island, which is a reference to the island of garbage that we saw earlier in the beginning of the movie. Right now, like at this point when I'm watching the movie, I don't get the connection, but we'll see it later, right? He says that on Garbage Island, the birds feast on the bones of the backsliding damned. The big idea, though, is that the folks in the church have somewhat of a personal responsibility to help be a corrective force for those with loose morals. Now, I personally think that God should do the smiting and the punishing, but it's a believable sermon topic, I guess. But the actual delivery of the sermon isn't 100% true to my experience either. It feels a little watered down. The preacher emphasizes like the wrong words when he's speaking, like Baptist preaching has a rhythm to it. And there's certain ways that you go up in tone and you come down and certain words you emphasize and certain ones you don't. And this particular actor who's portraying the pastor isn't doing it right or just isn't doing it the way that I grew up knowing how it was done. My grandfather is a Baptist preacher, so I do have some experience with, you know, Southern Baptist preachers, but this guy comes across more as being a caricature of a Southern preacher. And I'm wondering if that's actually the point, like if it's not supposed to be accurate, if it's supposed to be, like I said, a caricature. And it's kind of funny how the preacher goes from passionately talking about the damned souls on Garbage Island to saying a prayer. It's pretty funny. And so one of the things that comes up a little bit is hypocrisy a little bit. So let's keep going, y'all. Next up, GH comes over to the house to do the first practice with his band, right? More like a band of misfits. I also want to point out that Tom Hanks's character has teeth that are a little crooked and low-key look like he's wearing a gold tooth sometimes. This is hard to explain. I don't know if any of you have seen, there are certain people whose teeth are, they aren't overly crooked, but the teeth are fashioned in a way that it's like sometimes looks shiny. I don't know if it's lighting or whatever it is. It's really hard to explain. And I don't think you all will understand what I'm talking about. But anyway, his band unloads a hearse, which GH explains is the only vehicle large enough to carry the band and their large Renaissance, you know, aged instruments. His band is composed of the men that we met earlier, right? We got Gawain, who worked at the casino. We got Garth, who was the animal wrangler at that dog food commercial shoot. We got Lump, who was a football player, and we have the general, who was the male Asian owner of that donut shop that got robbed. So when the men are alone in the basement, they use a boombox to make it seem like they are rehearsing their Renaissance age instruments while they really go over their plan to rob the casino boat, the Bandit Queen. So we learn that Mississippi law dictates that while a casino can't be built on land, it can float, hence the floating casino boat. However, the structures to support the business of a floating casino can be on land. So the cash counting room that we saw earlier when Wemac and Gawain were working is actually connected to the boat by a tunnel, but it's on land. So Gawain is the mole inside the casino that reveals the schedule. Once a day, the cash is taken from the hold of the ship to the counting office, which is located underground. Now, after the casino closes, the underground offices are secured and the guard retreats to the ship, which is pretty far from the counting room. And while the doors are made of steel, the walls are regular building material such that the men can use the dirt from the cellar of Marva's house to dig into the casino counting room and steal the money. Seems like a decent plan, y'all. Now, the general has tunneling experience from his homeland of French Indochina and is responsible for, you know, helping and guiding to dig the hole. Garth Pancake is described as a master of none, and he'll be the jack of all trades who will fit in and has, you know, skills that can help where needed, including handling demolition and fabrication. Now, again, Gawain is the inside man. In the casino, we have Lump, who is the football player. He is security for the group and also the muscle. He isn't super smart. His character is depicted as being quite... Is plebeian the right word? What is the... There's a specific word that I'm trying to think of and I can't think of it. But essentially, he doesn't really speak in full sentences. The way he speaks comes across as if he's thinking really hard to say a few words. He speaks very slowly and with this dullness in his voice that lets you know that he's not very intelligent. And basically, the way he's gotten through life is by being strong. So a brute is the word that is used. I don't necessarily like the way this character is portrayed either. Let's go ahead and move on. This merry band of misfits is not high on intelligence, and I guess that's where the professor comes in. He is the brains of the operation. GH reveals that all of these guys answered an ad that he put in the paper, and I'm curious about what this ad said. What do you put in an ad to make people want to rob a casino with you without alerting the authorities that that's what you want to do? It doesn't make sense to me. Okay. But they're here. They have a mission. They have a plan, right? So they allow Lump to begin the digging and the tunneling starts, y'all. They make a large hole and use garbage bags to remove the displaced dirt. Now, it appears that only Lump and the general have concerned themselves with digging at this point. But I also want to point out that the soundtrack is interesting. It has this contrast between like the old school down home gospel music versus hip hop. It appears that like the Nappy Roots help contribute to this soundtrack and made rap songs that were probably specifically for this movie to show the connection between like the old school down home gospel that Marva listens to versus like the newer age hip hop. Something about that feels a little pandering to me, coming from the Coen brothers, considering how only one person in this merry band of misfits is Black and that the hip hop thread isn't fully woven throughout this story. For me, like, it's mentioned here and there, and then the soundtrack has some, I don't know, it feels a little bit out of place, and I think the story actually could have done without it. But overall, I think that the contrast between these two styles of music helps to highlight this recurring theme of, like, good versus evil, or bad versus pure. Again, I don't know that we needed to focus so much on hip-hop per se. I think it could have been done well using some other element, but whatever. Now, the men transport the bags of dirt to the bridge where they use that trash tugboat that we saw earlier that flows towards Garbage Island to get rid of the dirt for good. So basically, they go over the bridge, they wait for this little tugboat to go by, and then they drop the bags of dirt into the tugboat that's pulling trash that will eventually go to Trash Island. It's a quite interesting disposal system, and it comes back a lot in this movie. Now, the cat, Pickles, is actually a witness to all of this and accompanies the men to get rid of the dirt. The cat, again, was another element that I was like, okay. But later on, Marva knocks on the door of the cellar and the criminals have to rush back out of the hole pretending to practice their instruments. They actually have a large sheet that is covering the hole so that it is not visible to Marva when she comes downstairs. Marva wants to show the guys something, but she starts asking questions like, why is Lump all sweaty? Now, this forces Gawain to try to explain it away, and he does so in a vulgar manner, which results in a couple of slaps to correct his behavior. I find that this is quite hypocritical, right? She starts to recite some of the things from the sermon that we heard earlier, right? Like, it's a slap upside the head, like, it's your duty, it's for your own good. And sometimes that's, what does she say? Something along the lines of, like, sometimes this is what it takes, and it's like, well, you're resorting to physical violence to correct someone's behavior. And it comes across as a little hypocritical to me. Gawain gets really mad at being hit by this older lady, and the professor has to whisk Marva away, explaining it, you know, as fiery youth. Marva says, well, when I was a youth, I was in church. I wasn't fiery. That was very funny to me. It was very funny to me. And she is a holier than thou woman at this stage in her life, but it was pretty funny. Back upstairs in the living room, Marva shows GH a fife, or she calls it a Khalil, that Othar, her deceased husband, made himself, thinking that GH would be interested in it since he's into music. It was actually a very sweet gesture. Marva gets a little sad talking about her husband, who's been passed away for like 20 years now. They have this weird conversation about Othar blowing the shofar, which is a ceremonial horn, but I don't get it. I have a suspicion that a joke went over my head and that maybe GH was suggesting something about Othar that Marva either was unwilling to admit or didn't understand. Let's see. Let me look it up. Y'all, I tried to look it up. I think it was another instance where GH brought up the shofar, or shofar, I don't know how to pronounce it, and she just was really confused. She was like, no, Othar never blew no shofar. I don't know what you're talking about. Okay, yeah, got it. For a split second, I was suspicious of Othar's passing, like for a split second, y'all. Back at the casino, Gawain is hitting on a female patron, particularly from behind, and ends up being fired by Mr. Gudge, which is the first misstep in the plan. Gawain and Mr. Gudge have a funny conversation about the firing, but we'll move on. I'm curious about how this changes the plan and what will happen to Gawain now that he's not necessarily useful to the group anymore. Now, the merry band of misfits go to the Waffle Hut, y'all, and the five of them are having breakfast, and GH is really upset about Gawain's dismissal from the casino, and Gawain really has no interest in kissing Mr. Gudge's butt in order to get his job back. Apparently, it's his thuggish young black male pride that's preventing him from trying to get his job back, despite it being pretty important to the plan of them robbing the casino. Now, Pancake comes with some more bad news, claiming that while they were digging, they ran into a large rock, which is stopping them from, you know, continuing the dig. Pancake assures them that they can blow through the rock, but then suddenly a woman named Mountain Girl, who is Pancake's partner and procurer of materials, comes up and kisses him. Everybody at the table, and me too, are shocked now that a sixth person knows of and is kind of involved in their plans. So she has been like securing supplies for him in this robbery, and they were like, whoa, you didn't tell us that you like looped your lady in on this plan. They weren't really happy about it. The person who's unhappiest about it is Gawain, and he keeps saying that Pancake brought his B word to the Waffle Hut, and he's like, you brought your B to the Waffle Hut. He's particularly perturbed because everyone is like harping on him for losing his job when, you know, Garth Pancake is over here involving his lady. They both messed up. But now Pancake gets tired of Gawain calling Mountain Girl out of her name, and he starts to hem Gawain up. Now Gawain, though, pulls a gun on Pancake. And so GH, you know, calms him down and says that Mountain Girl is a part of the group now and she can only get Pancake's share, right? You know, we're not divvying up six ways. Whatever she gets is going to be from Pancake's share. So this begins a kind of contentious relationship between Gawain and Pancake, and they exchange a lot of insults in this particular scene and in future scenes. To be fair, Pancake eventually tries to resolve things just to kind of keep the peace, but Gawain is really just not interested. He comes across as a hothead. Again, don't like how this character, there's no real depth to the character. He's just a hothead who doesn't seem to necessarily have his eye on the prize. He doesn't come across as particularly smart. Yeah, I just don't like the way this character. I don't like the character, but more so I don't like the way that they have made this character and how it feels like this character was made to be black to exploit certain stereotypes. That's the way it's coming across to me. But anyways, as GH is trying to figure out what to do about Gawain losing his job, Lump raises his hand and offers a suggestion of bribing Mr. Gudge, which is a pretty good suggestion for a not so smart brute. So Lump got some intelligence about him, y'all. We got to give him a little bit of credit. I wish they would. I wish they would give him some credit. But back at the house, GH and Marva are sitting together chatting. There are a number of times in this movie where GH and Marva sit and have conversations, which I think is a little cute. But they talk about books, and GH recites what I believe is a line from the works of Edgar Allan Poe. He calls him his favorite writer and just thinks that he was, you know, great at weaving words and whatnot. And this comes back a little later. Now, Marva doesn't really get it. She's like, Edgar Allan Poe's a little spooky. And she's like, what about the word of God? And she is an interrupter. And in a lot of ways, it's pretty funny. Her having conversations highlights a little bit of a lack of intelligence and this preoccupation with Jesus and religion. GH gives Marva a gift, 2 tickets to see Mighty Clouds of Joy, which is a real gospel group that will be performing in Memphis. There are some interesting pieces of this story that feel more real, right? Like the Mighty Clouds of Joy are like a legit gospel group, right? Things that bring us kind of back to reality. GH has arranged a car to take her and a friend there, and is clearly to get her away from the house and presumably the blast that will happen when they demolish the rock that is in their way. Now, suddenly there's a knock on the door and it is Sheriff Wayne. The professor is mortified to hear that a man of the law is at the door. And so Marva goes to open the door, and the sheriff is only there for a brief second to say that he talked to Wemack about playing his music too loud and that Wemack will honor Miss Munson's request. Marva says that she has someone that she wants the sheriff to meet. And even though the sheriff says that he's pressed for time, she takes him around the house attempting to find GH because he is gone, y'all. He left. He took his teacup. He was like, she's not going to introduce me to this lawman. Okay. And so eventually she takes him up to the bedroom that GH is renting out. And like I said, you know, funnily enough, he took his dishes with him and he has left the room in such good condition that it looks like Marva is actually exaggerating or hallucinating that someone is living there with her. GH almost gets caught as he's hiding under the bed, and Marva gets down on, you know, on her knees and looks under the bed and is laughing at the professor for having tea down there. And he's trying to shush her and tell her to stop talking. But from the viewpoint of the sheriff, it just looks like an old lady who is having visions of someone hanging out under the bed and kind of amusing herself. Not anything harmful or to the point of, I guess, like dementia or anything like that. He doesn't see anything. There's no evidence that anyone is actually there. And he actually has to get home to his wife. So while she's fool-la-laing around down there, he gets a page and he has to leave. So he actually never meets GH. The professor plays it off saying that he was playing a game because apparently academics are always trying to find their ways into small spaces. I have no idea what that's a reference to. Now, at the casino, Gawain, you know, goes back and gives Mr. Gudge a box of chocolates as an apology, along with a card that has a $100 bill inside of it. Mr. Gudge is easily bought with this $100, and Gawain now has a 1-week probationary period. So he is back in the good graces of Mr. Gudge and is again an employee of the casino. Now, in the cellar, Pancake tries to resolve his issues with Gawain by revealing his ties to the Freedom Riders, but Gawain does not care and didn't even know who the Freedom Riders were. Y'all, I don't like these stereotypes. Now, right as they are about to fight, Marva brings down cinnamon cookies before she heads to Memphis for the concert with Miss Funthis, which is Wemack's mother and a friend of hers, presumably from the neighborhood and possibly church. Now, Marva asks them to perform at the church, but GH goes to see the ladies out, and GH charms Miss Funthis as they're walking out to the car, right? And so down in the cellar during the same time, Pancake does a safety meeting regarding the explosives. He claims that they will use the same method with the explosives to close the tunnel after the robbery is over. Now, right as GH is putting the ladies in the car, Pancake, who is demonstrating that apparently C4 is supposed to be stable if it's not hooked up to the other elements of the bomb, hits the C4 with a hammer, and there's an explosion, y'all. He hits the C4 with a hammer, and there's an explosion that's loud enough that the ladies and GH, who are at the car, hear it from outside. Marva, who, you know, they haven't driven away yet, is concerned about her house, obviously. Now, from the outside, we see some dust kind of shake off a little bit, and we heard like a muffled boom, but the house kind of seems fine from the outside. There's clearly something going on that's out of the ordinary. Now, when Marva tries to get out of the car to see what's up, GH tells her that he'll take care of it by calling like the water company or the gas company or whoever, and that she can go ahead and go to her concert. For whatever reason, she doesn't investigate further. She actually leaves to go to the concert, y'all. Now, GH runs to the house in a really funny way. It's hilarious. As Lump reaches the top of the cellar stairs saying, blood. Pancake lost a finger in the explosion, and Gawain says that it can be sewed back on like John Bobbitt. Now, the John and Lorena Bobbitt situation happened in the summer of 1993. So now I'm thinking that this movie takes place even later in the 90s than I thought. Now, Marva and her friend are still outside the house, and Pickles the cat now has the severed finger. G.H. explains to Martha that Pancake got his finger caught in his musical instrument and they need to go to the hospital. And then the general tries to chase down Pickles the cat to retrieve the finger. So some silly stuff going on, y'all. Now, next up in this next scene, it's Sunday. And even though they experience some setbacks, they are on schedule to get into the vault while Marva is at church. Now, it turns out that they already demolished the rock when Marva was at choir practice. So they had a second opportunity to do that. They couldn't do it when she went to Memphis because, of course, the finger incident. They are just a few feet from entering the vault. Y'all, hold on. Did they really take this man to a hospital? Why would six potential casino robbers go to the hospital together? Okay, moving on. Let's move on, y'all. Okay. Apparently, the robbers are just a few feet away from entering the vault. And when GH asks Pancake if he can get the job done with a missing finger, he decides to ask for a larger cut of the money as a workman's comp situation for the loss of his digit. And everybody is like, WTF. They start arguing about it, and for the first time, even the general pipes in to say that Pancake should not get an extra share. At this point, the general had been silent. I don't think he actually said any words up to this point in the movie, so he thought this was important enough to pipe up. GH gave a more academic and logical explanation that, like, you can't do dishonest work and expect to get workman's comp. But Pancake relents as majority rules, and his request is denied, and he's kind of not that mad about it. They synchronize watches so they can connect with Gawain as the inside man, but that's a mess because Lump doesn't have a watch and they're all idiots a little bit. So it was interesting. The scene, that part of the scene with the synchronized watches only lasted a few seconds, but it was quite funny to me. Now at the church, the choir is singing, and in the background, the plan to, you know, breach into the counting room wall is in motion, right? So Gawain arrives to work at the empty casino. The only person who is there is the guard Elrond, and he is basically closer to the entrance of the casino, which is on the boat and pretty far away from where the underground tunnel is to get to, like, the counting room and some of the other offices, right? So Gawain enters the hallway from the boat that goes to the counting room, and he waits outside the counting room door, nervous. We see a drill come through the counting room wall right as Marva leaves church early. So for whatever reason, she leaves church early, and it looks like she has something to do, but at this point, we don't know what it is. Now, the guys let Gawain into the counting room to get the loot. Now, unfortunately, Pancake has a run-in with his IBS. At this point, we hadn't seen it that much. There was a point where he was talking, and his stomach was bubbling quite a bit, but we didn't know that it was like full-blown IBS. But in the counting room, his IBS starts acting up and he needs Gawain to show him to the men's room. Now, this, of course, increases the risk that the men will be caught because Elrond, the guard, is still on duty, even though the casino is closed and empty. And so they have to leave the underground area and go into the casino to go to the men's room. Pancake finishes his business and goes on a loud rant. He was so loud, y'all. A loud rant about IBS and how he met his partner, Mountain Girl, at an IBS meetup. But Gawain wasn't trying to hear all of that. What was interesting is how loud the man was talking and why Gawain didn't tell him to shut up. Why didn't the guard hear him? There's certain things in this movie that don't make no sense to me, okay? Anyways, they head back to the counting room. The men grab the loot inside of trash bags, and three of the men returned through the hole that they dug, right? Leaving Gawain to finish his shift and hide the evidence of the hole by rebuilding the bricks and drywall, which is actually pretty clever. So to the naked eye, it'll appear as if the wall was always in place and all right, and that there was, you know, nobody would be the wiser. And he did a fantastic job with that drywall, if I must say. Now, right as the men are crawling back into the cellar, like coming out of the hole away from the casino, Marva comes home. The men have counted the money, and minus Gawain, they do a toast because Gawain has to finish his shift, right? So GH does a moving toast about the feat they pulled off and how they'll talk about it in the distant future with their grandchildren and, you know, whatever, whatever, X, Y, and Z, right? And so Pancake realizes that the charge that's supposed to go off to close the tunnel hasn't gone off. So he was supposed to set off a bomb that destroyed the evidence that a tunnel was ever dug, right? I don't know how that works. I don't, like, what happens to the ground above it? Does it sink down? I don't know how underground demolition works, y'all. So this is another wrinkle in the plan. So far, they have been successful, right? They had a few other wrinkles, but they got the money, they got what they came for, and all they got to do is clean things up, right? Clean it up a little bit. And so Pancake goes back into the tunnel to figure out what's going on with the bomb, right? And a few little things happen. Like I said, Gawain finishes a really good drywall job, and I'm like, why isn't he doing drywall in real life? He can make some good money. But Pancake, who's in the tunnel with the little detonator device, has an IBS flare up right as he tries to fool with the timing device on the bomb. There appears to be like a malfunction where the clock ended up stopping at 14 seconds. So he tries to unscrew the back of the little detonator, but when he taps the timing device, it activates it and it starts counting down again. So Pancake at first, instead of just getting out of there, decided to try to screw off the back of the timing device to deactivate it, but he couldn't do it. He was too nervous and his IBS was flaring up. So he ended up changing his mind and hightailing it out of the hole right before it blew up, making him fly out of the hole and over the money. And so the money gets sent flying around the room. And Marva, who is home early, hears the blast and opens the cellar door because she sees smoke coming from underneath it. Now, back at the casino, the guard Elrond also hears the blast, but Gawain is able to play it off, claiming that the guard farted. So it's a joke similar to the ones that Weemak cracked earlier in the movie when he was talking to this guard as well. Because again, the guard is supposed to be big and nasty and whatever, whatever. Okay. Now, when Marva opens the cellar door, she sees smoke and dollar bills flying. Marva is mad at the man. The general is smoking in her house, but she doesn't seem to 100% grasp what's really going on. She says she wants to talk to the professor later and closes the cellar door. She doesn't ask enough questions for me, and we find out why, because right after this happens, the doorbell rings and Marva welcomes in a lot of church ladies into her house, which will make future interactions or their escape pretty hard. Marva comes down to the cellar and says she wants to hear an explanation about what they've been up to, but in the meantime, the ladies want to hear them play their fancy instruments. So when the men go upstairs, GH says that they can't play without Gawain, and he offers to recite some poetry from Edgar Allan Poe. And so the ladies are captivated by, you know, his recital of the poetry. They actually really enjoy it, and when he's done, they're like, amen. It's kind of strange. It's strange. But Gawain comes over and sees all the ladies in the house, and he's like kind of confused about what's going on. But later that night, the ladies head home and Marva demands to know what's going on from the men. So some of the guys are helping to clean up after the little soiree. And GH starts to tell Marva a pretty good lie about what they were doing down there. He says that Lump is a collector of artifacts and found an arrowhead in the basement and enlisted the rest of the band to dig in the cellar to find more, you know, artifacts. He says that they also came across a pocket of natural gas. And when the general lit a cigarette, which is forbidden in the house, you don't smoke, in Big Mama Marva's house, it caused an explosion, right? And so when she asks about the money, GH says that it is the proceeds of Pancake's sale of his home because he does not trust banks and carries large amounts of money with him in a trash bag. She doesn't really like this explanation and says that she is going to call the sheriff. And GH is like, nah, you can't do that. You can't do that. It's very interesting to watch GH panic because in this movie, he is quite calm. He can weave a story. He can tell a tale. He's very good with his words. He is a lady killer, right? But the moments where she brings up the police, to see that frantic nature is hilarious to me because it comes across as being really out of character for him. It's quite funny. And so GH is like, okay, it was a lie. I will tell you the truth in private. And so GH and Marva sit down in the living room and he tells her that they are not musicians. They are criminals. He tells her the real truth with like a little bit of a little white lie caveat, right? Like he labels the casino as a den of iniquity. And he says that they have stolen their funds with plans to make a donation of some of the proceeds or a share of the proceeds to Bob Jones University. He basically says that the crime is victimless and that the casino has insurance and that the insurance policy holders will only be charged like 1 cent each for, you know, this crime. Now, he claims that they did the math. I don't know how true that is. Now, GH wants Marva to keep this a secret. He's like, if you keep this a secret, Bob Jones University, and she's been donating $5 a month to Bob Jones University for a number of years. But he's like, you know, Bob Jones University gets, you know, a little share of some money. We get our share. That den of iniquity gets robbed. Nobody gets hurt, right? And so Marva is kind of enamored with this, y'all. I'm just realizing how important it is to the story of how charming and convincing GH is for this older lady, because she gets to the point where she really is like into it. And she's like, oh, Bob Jones University will get some money and we'll be, you know, making it difficult for those, you know, sinners down at the casino. And she gets caught up in this idea of this crime being okay, essentially. So Marva almost goes along with this plan until she looks at the picture of her deceased husband, Othar, and is overcome with guilt. She says she won't call the police if they give the money back and go to church with her next Sunday. And she says, y'all can go to church or y'all can go to jail. So GH reports back to the band of misfits, and the men are sad. They are basically in a chokehold by this older lady. Gawain suggests, you know, all we got to do is kill her. But GH doesn't think that's a good option, publicity wise or morally. It's like, this is a small town. If an old lady ends up dead, this is going to look bad, and it'll be more reason, I guess, for people to come after them. And killing a nice old church going lady is not good on the conscience either. So they brainstorm. And they decide to kill her and bury her inside the hole in the cellar. Apparently, this is a reference to an Edgar Allan Poe story. I actually read this story before. I'm trying to think of the name of it. The Cask of Amontillado. Amontillado. I cannot pronounce this, but I believe it's a nod to that story, kind of. So the guys end up drawing straws to see who will pull the trigger. Apparently, they're going to shoot her with Gawain's gun. And Gawain pulls the short straw. It was his idea. He goes upstairs with his gun. And the idea is that he's going to use a pillow to muffle the sound. And so he grabs like a little couch pillow and, you know, he approaches her from behind as she's in her rocking chair facing like the fireplace, right? Now, weirdly, we get a flashback to when Gawain was a child. Now, the child version of himself is played by the same actor who played the young boy on the Bernie Mac show. I don't know this child's name, but I thought that was pretty funny. But this flashback is odd. I was not expecting this at all. But this flashback shows Gawain's mother and how she was verbally and physically abusive to him for bringing home a dog. Yeah, so instead of like gearing up to shoot and kill Marva, he's clutching the pillow and crying over his childhood trauma a little bit. And Marva hears him and beats him up with the pillow, saying that she's so disappointed that a nice young black man got caught up with those criminals. And Gawain returns to the cellar saying that he couldn't shoot her because she reminds him too much of his own mother. So emotionally, it was just something he couldn't do, even though it was his idea to kill her. I just don't think that he thought that he would get the short straw. Now, down in the cellar, Gawain wants them to draw straws again, but the rest of the crew says he's got to kill her. Of course, an argument ends up breaking out between Gawain and Pancake because those two cannot get along, and they get into a shoving match while Gawain has a gun in his hand. And when the gun goes off, Gawain dies. And so the men dispose of Gawain's body in a hefty bag while GH tells Marva about their decision to return the money and to go to church with her. So from their standpoint, the message that they're giving Marva is that they are repenting of their sins. They'll go to church with her on Sunday. Okay. So while loading Gawain's body into the hearse, a van can be seen up the street. And the lights on this van flash twice and Pancake smiles. So I'm guessing it's Mountain Girl giving him a signal or something. So now I'm getting a little suspicious of Pancake, right? So the General and Lump dispose of Gawain's body on the tugboat that's headed to Garbage Island, right? By this time it's nighttime, so they have at least the cover of darkness, right? While Pancake packs up the money to supposedly get ready to pack it in the hearse, saying that, oh, the General and the Lump are back now, right? Like, so I'm gonna go put this in the hearse. So a suspicious GH opens the remaining instrument case to see that the money is gone and it's full of magazines. So this means that Pancake took all of the money and headed to the van to meet up with Mountain Girl. So around this time, the General and Lump actually do come back by now. And so on his way to the van, Pancake's IBS strikes again. And by now, all of the remaining criminals know that they have been double-crossed. So right as he's loading the money into the van, he gets strangled by the General. And so the noises of him being strangled apparently are the same noises he makes when he has like an issue with his IBS. So anyways, Now, the remaining guys end up disposing of Garth's body as well as Mountain Girl's body. So they had to kill her, too. She also knew about the plan and was a part of the plan of double crossing everybody. So she had to go, too, apparently. There was a little visual joke about Mountain Girl's hairy legs, too. But let's keep going. Now, back at the house, the remaining criminals, who are Lump, the General, and GH, draw strings again to see who's going to kill Marva. The General draws the short straw this time. So by this time, Marva is asleep. It's bedtime, y'all. He enters her room preparing to strangle her. Now, for whatever reason, he keeps smoking in her house. She has asked him not to smoke all the time. But whenever he is smoking and he is about to get caught with a cigarette, instead of putting it out, he does this thing where he folds up the cigarette into his mouth to hide it. I don't know how you hide a burning cigarette inside your mouth or where you need to be in life to do that. But he manages, okay? So he goes into her room getting ready to strangle her, and a cuckoo clock on the wall goes off, startling him, which causes him to swallow the cigarette that he held in his mouth. And so he actually tries drinking Marva's denture water from her side table to help, but he has to leave the room to, you know, try to save himself from choking, right? And Marva is still asleep. She's actually sleeping through this. But as he tries to go down the stairs, the cat comes up the stairs at the same time, and he jumps over the cat and falls down the stairs to his death. It's very silly, kind of Looney Tunes-ish, comical. And the falling down the stairs scene felt very real. It didn't look like a dummy had fallen down the stairs. It looked like maybe a person actually fell down the stairs. It's quite interesting. We see another disapproving look from Othar's painting in the living room. So there's this recurring theme that Othar actually may be watching over his wife and protecting her from these criminals a little bit. So there's the picture that's up in the living room has come up a number of times in the movie, but this time actually was like a little bit more noticeable than the other times as well. The last two guys dispose of the General on the tugboat as well. He actually had an accidental death, but GH admits that he is in over his head and that, you know, Marva is a little bit more formidable than he thought. And so he says, you know, Lump, you know, it's your turn to draw the short straw. And Lump is like, I've been thinking. And GH is like, dang, I can't believe you said that. Or like, I really wish you didn't say that. Or I was hoping that you wouldn't be thinking. But essentially, Lump is having second thoughts, right? Lump is like, maybe Marva is right about us, you know, going straight and going to church and turning our lives around. And GH is reminding Lump about his role in the crew. You are the brute force guy. I, GH, am the smart guy. It's your turn to do what you're supposed to do in, you know, the roles that we have been given within this criminal enterprise, okay? And GH hands him the gun, saying that if Lump doesn't kill her, that GH will have to do it, and then Lump won't be entitled to any of the money. And then Lump says, I can't let you kill her. And GH is indignant that Lump feels like he'd be able to tell GH what to do. GH calls Lump stupid, and Lump aims and fires the gun at GH, and he's like, who's stupid now? But he pulls the trigger, and nothing happens. The gun doesn't work. And so Lump looks into the barrel of the gun and pulls the trigger again, killing himself. And so he ends up falling onto the next trash tugboat that is going underneath the bridge below. So GH is the only remaining criminal, and he ends up spotting a raven similar to the bird that we saw earlier in the movie, and recites some more of Edgar Allan Poe, who has a work called The Raven. And in a crazy, unexpected turn of events, the head of the gargoyle-like figure that I talked about at the very beginning of the movie falls off, hits GH on the head, knocking him out and sending him on his last ride to Trash Island with the rest of the crew. Briefly, like, his Colonel Sanders jacket or overcoat thing gets caught on the bridge, but it ends up ripping off and he falls into the trash, y'all, and dies from, I guess, blunt force trauma. I was not expecting that. That was crazy to me that they all kind of got, y'all. Well, in the morning, Marva wakes up and sees some evidence of the previous night's events, but she kind of writes them off. There's a number of things that happened in this movie that Marva just really doesn't address, I guess. I don't know. Anyways, the newspaper reveals that $1.6 million was stolen from a casino and no one knows how. So they got $1.6 million. Now, let's see. What is $1.6 million divided by 5? It is 0.32 million. So if they had survived, each one of the criminals would have gotten $320,000. Does that seem worth it? let me see, $320,000, and let's say the movie happened in 1994 in today's money. All right, $320,000 in 1994 is $674,000 today. So more than double that. Y'all, is $674,000 in today's money enough for you to rob a casino and almost get caught? I don't know, y'all. I don't think that's worth it personally. Now, Marva recognizes that all of the men are gone, but the money is still in her cellar in neat stacks. So she goes back to the sheriff's office where the movie started, and they are super busy trying to figure out what happened to the money. The fact that a casino robbery happened to these cops in this very sleepy town, of course, should be overwhelming for them. I'm surprised that the FBI isn't there, but we'll move on. She comes into the office to make her statement, saying that the money that was stolen from the casino is in her cellar. Marva tells them about the criminals and how they stole the money and how she guilted them into leaving town without taking the money. The sheriffs, who don't believe a thing Mrs. Munson is saying, tells her to keep the money, thinking that she's weaving more incoherent stories. She asks if she really can keep it. And when they say yes, she says, well, as long as we all agree. And she's like, well, maybe I can give it to Bob Jones University. And the sheriff is like, sure, that's a great idea. And so she leaves the sheriff's office super happy and heads home. And of course, Pickles gets out again and heads to the bridge where he drops Pancake's finger onto the last trash barge headed for Garbage Island. Y'all, that's the end of the movie. Marva was telling the truth in the end and nobody believed her. All right, y'all, that's the end of the film. Now, at the end of every review, we ask the same two questions. Is it worth a rewatch and does it hold up today? I'm gonna say no on the rewatchability. Now, while there were parts of the movie that were pretty funny and the story had some campiness and folliness to it, it didn't feel entertaining enough to make me want to watch it again. The acting was generally good. I mean, Tom Hanks is always good in anything that he does. Marlon Wayans always knows how to act a fool. J.K. Simmons is a great actor. Lump did a good job. The general, even in his quietness, did a good job as well. Irma P. Hall did a great job as Marva too. So all of the actors are very capable. But something about the film feels uneasy for me, and I'm trying to put my finger on it. For me, knowing that the original movie was British makes me think that there may be some elements of the story that are better suited for British humor, which doesn't necessarily jive with my sense of humor. I also think that I may not like the style of the Coen brothers. The only other film of theirs that I've seen is Bad Santa. And while that movie is funny, I have a hard time rewatching it as well because it has this dark humor element that I'm just not a big fan of. It makes me really uncomfortable and I can't really explain why. They Americanized and modernized a old British concept, and while it doesn't fall completely flat, I just kind of don't care for their reinterpretation or imagination for this particular film. Now, when it comes to this movie holding up today, I had to think pretty hard about this one, and I feel like the movie only kind of holds up today. Now, if you remove the hip hop element of this story, this film seems like it's much older than it actually is. The way that GH speaks, Marva's old school values, and the general sleepiness of this town can make you think that the movie takes place in or before, like, maybe even the 60s or 70s. But the modernization of this tale mostly relies on hip hop and street culture in the form of some of the music, as well as the pretty bad attitude and kind of thuggish ways of Gawain, the character that's played by Marlon Wayans. And I don't like that they used Marlon Wayans to portray so many stereotypes. Yeah, I didn't like that. I also didn't like the way Pancake interacted with Gawain, who interacted with Gawain by lauding his freedom fighting past over him and saying things like, you know, we fought so you would have the right to vote. And then Gawain responding with, I don't even vote, so that doesn't even matter. And it's like, ugh, why? Why are we portraying Black people like this? I can't. I don't like this. I don't like it, y'all. I also don't really like that the men in the town, particularly the sheriff and the deputy, didn't really listen to or pay attention to Marva's concerns. And I can't put my finger on it, but something feels weird about them casting a younger Black man and an older Black woman to play the role of Marva. Again, something about it comes across as like a way to play out stereotypes, and I really don't like that. The positive, though, is that I enjoy a good heist movie, and the heist is the best part of the film. Not only was it a decent plan that was carried out by a band of misfits, and the fact that they ran into challenges and managed to solve those things was actually pretty interesting, and they essentially succeeded in their task, but they really didn't have what it took to finish the job, which would have meant killing Marva. Now, that really is the part of the story that I enjoyed the most, was the mechanics of them actually getting through the wall and like pulling off this heist. There was the intensity, right, of like, are they going to get caught? Why is Pancake talking so freaking loud in this casino? Like those types of things. There was a lot of intensity around that. And I really enjoyed that element of the movie. But I mean, there were other things that were wrong, right? Like I found Marva to be quite unlikable sometimes. I felt like the church scene was almost too tame for a Southern Baptist church. And at one point I was actually rooting for the bank robbers against Miss Marva. So I don't even know if she's supposed to be likable in this film, y'all. There were times where she was talking and was just so uptight and I really don't know if she's supposed to be likable or not. That's the same question I asked when she was Big Mama in Soul Food. Ultimately, I came away from this story feeling confused, really. They kept putting emphasis on Othar's picture as if his ghost was looking out for Marva. And then they incorporated the cat into it, which kind of made me feel like was Othar's spirit inside of the cat or not. He wasn't really germane to the story, but they used him a little bit. I don't know what I'm supposed to learn from this, right? Like, am I supposed to come away with the idea that the trash takes itself out or that God protects babies and fools? Yeah, I low-key didn't like this movie, and I don't know why I was so excited to watch it in the first place. Now let's talk about ratings. The critics over at Rotten Tomatoes gave this movie a 54%, while audience members gave it 43%. I think the audience is more on point with this. I really don't think the Coen Brothers' style of dark humor is for me. And it's not that I don't get it per se, it's just more that I don't like it. And I'm okay with that hard truth. Now that's all, folks. Thanks so much for listening to my review of The Lady Killers from 2004 here at Sub Media Reviews. Listeners, what are your thoughts on this movie? Does it hold up for you? Did you rewatch it recently? Share your thoughts with us on social media, on Facebook, Instagram, and YouTube. Join us next time when we celebrate Teachers Appreciation Week with a review of the 1989 film Lean on Me, featuring a young-ish Morgan Freeman. You don't want to miss it. Peace out. Thanks for listening to Sub Media Reviews. I hope you enjoyed our trip down memory lane just as much as I did. If you have any suggestions for movies or TV shows you'd like me to review next, or if you just want to share your thoughts on today's episode, you can find us on Instagram, Facebook, YouTube, and Pinterest at Sub Media Reviews and on submediareviews.com. Don't forget to subscribe to the podcast so you never miss an episode. And if you have a moment, please leave a review on your favorite podcast platform. Your feedback helps me improve the show and spread the word to new listeners. So until next time, peace out, home slices.